You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Wood.
And I'm Jennifer Connor.
From Equestrian Businesswomen, and you're listening to Equestrian B2B, the podcast that brings together industry leaders, entrepreneurs, and equestrians for conversations about how they build and sustain a successful business.
On today's show, we speak with attorney Kimberl Hines about the importance of contracts. She breaks down the different types, what you should think about, and how to protect yourself with contracts.
Kimberl Hines is an experienced equestrian and equine attorney. In her practice, Kimberl helps horse professionals and enthusiasts navigate the legal and business challenges of the horse industry. Kimberl represents clients in an array of equine-related legal issues, including sale disputes, waivers and purchase, breeding and lease agreements, and USEF, FEI, and other breed and show agency rule violations. Before practicing equine law, Kimberl practiced business law and commercial litigation with a special focus on labor and employment law issues.
Prior to her career in law, Kimberl had a career in human resource management. Kimberl's education includes a Juris Doctor from the University of Florida, where Kimberl was an articles editor for the Florida Law Review and served as president of the Employment and Labor Law Society. Kimberl holds a Master of Science in Human Resource Management from the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, and a Bachelor of Arts in Political Science with a minor in Business Administration from the University of Florida. Equestrian Businesswomen is excited to host the second annual EQBW meetup with a party and a supporting women in business vendor market at the 2025 Saratoga Women in Business Spectacular Horse Show at White Hollow Farm in Stillwater, New York. The Saratoga Women in Business Spectacular is the first ever horse show created by women, operated by women, benefiting women's health, and showcasing businesswomen throughout the equestrian industry and beyond.
Local and equestrian women-owned businesses are welcome to participate in a vendor market, and everyone is invited to attend the meetup and party free of charge. Don't miss the opportunity to engage in a fun afternoon, support women in business, and watch fantastic competition at the Saratoga Women in Business Spectacular Show. For more information, visit www.saratogahorseshows.com.
We're really fortunate today to have Kimberl Hines on. She's a really good friend of ours, a huge supporter of Equestrian Business Women, and we appreciate that so much. And she is also a lawyer and is here today to talk a little bit about contracts. So thank you so much, Kimberl.
Thanks for having me.
So I know that contracts can be not the most exciting topic, but I think it's a very important topic for us to chat about, because I think you, as you probably experience in the equine industry, we don't think about it enough.
Yes. Well, I mean, I certainly think it's exciting, but I agree with you. We don't think about contracts as often as we should. We do make them all the time, whether we realize it or not, but the horse industry is crazy and it's dynamic. So having good contracts is essential for everyone, even if you're not necessarily a horse professional.
Right. Yeah. Can you kind of talk about what a contract is, and so people get a clear idea of if they're making a contract and they don't even know it, or?
So in law, we define a contract as having an offer, meaning somebody, you know, makes an offer, proposes something, acceptance, the other side accepts, and what we consider consideration. So there's some sort of value that's being exchanged. It doesn't always have to be monetary, but for the most part, the value in contracts is going to be some sort of monetary amount. So there's also oral contracts and written contracts. And then certain types of contracts have to be in writing. Otherwise, the law deems that those aren't actually contracts. So different states have different interpretations of contract law in their state. So it's important for people when they're putting these contracts together to be paying really close attention to what their state requires.
When I was thinking about this, I didn't really think about it till now, but with the different states, if you're making a contract with people who are in a different state, like whose state rules over the contract?
That's a good question. So in my contracts, and I hope in most contracts that somebody is using a lawyer for, there's some sort of provision that states which law is actually going to govern the contract, because especially in horses, you could have someone who's in California and somebody else who's in Florida, and the states could have vastly different interpretations of what is a contract and how they interpret those contracts. Also, especially with horses, we have people who are making contracts with people overseas and in different countries. And in that case, again, there needs to be some sort of provision in the document that says this contract is governed by this particular state law. And certain states could be more advantageous to you. So it can be worthwhile to specify which state governs. If there isn't a provision that states where the contract is actually going to be enforced, a court could look at a few different things, where the action took place. So let's say it's the sale of a horse. If there's no provision in the agreement that says this contract is governed by this state law, then the court would look at where the horse was sold or where the parties are located. And that would be something that attorneys, if there was some sort of dispute, would likely argue about.
What makes a contract legal and binding?
A few things are really important. Possibly the most obvious is a signature. And I see this with all sorts of contracts, especially waivers. I have clients that do great things. They get their waivers done, really robust protections for them, really being careful about making sure that their waivers cover them from things that might fall out of their particular state's equine immunity statute. And then what happens in some barns is that these contracts get misplaced because they were signed on paper and it gets shoved into a tack box or the weather. You can imagine that sometimes they get lost. So that's a huge problem. And it's going to be difficult to enforce a contract if you can't find it and there's no signature. So first and foremost is having one written down, ideally. And then the second is getting it signed. And then the third is keeping a copy.
Mm-hmm. And if you make a digital copy of something that was, you know, a paper copy and signed paper copy, does that still count?
It should. Every state is a little bit different, and I can't speak to every state, but in most states, that's going to be valid evidence of a contract. Of course, we could go down the rabbit hole of, like, was this truly someone's signature, and anything could be argued. But for the most part, yeah, an electronic copy is generally considered to be just as good as the physical signed copy. A whole nother can of worms would be like wills. An electronic copy is not always the same as a physical signed copy. But when we're talking about sale agreements, waivers, those types of things, typically an electronic signature is going to be fine. And if you have a photo of the original that was physically signed, in most cases, that's going to be just as good as the original.
And what about verbal contracts?
Verbal contracts can be a little tricky. So in law, there's something called the statute of frauds. And basically, certain things have to be in writing in order for them to be enforceable. And again, it can be state specific, but things that can't be completed within 1 year generally have to be in writing. the sale of goods for more than $500 generally have to be in writing. But that's not to say that you can't have oral contracts. You can definitely have them. And what happens a lot of times is people will have a contract or like for a lease, as an example, and then the parties sign it, everything's all figured out with the lease. And then 6 months in, something happens and the parties make another agreement and like, oh, the horse was lame. Would you sub out another one? And then the question becomes, is there a second contract? And I think there's going to be some evidence that there was. So the oral contracts definitely come up, but if best case scenario, you have it in writing, that's always going to be the preferred method. And it's just a good exercise for everyone to kind of know what everyone's thinking and make sure that everyone's kind of on the same page. It's been great in recent years to see so many people come into the horse industry. I see a lot of newcomers. I see a lot of parents who are buying horses for the first time for their kids. I think since 2020, we have seen the industry expand in a lot of ways. And I also see a lot of issues with that because you have people who are new to the horse industry who are not used to the way that things have always been done. And in a lot of pockets of the horse industry, there weren't sale agreements and everything was done on kind of a handshake deal. And it's a small world, so people didn't really sue each other. And horses are just dangerous. And as horse people, we know those things. And we also have to manage the risk of all of these newcomers who are not horse people, who may not have the same expectations. And that's not going to be what you want to rely on. You're not going to regret having a contract. And sometimes you start making the contract, and I would just consider it business planning or even an exercise. Because as you start making those adjustments and you have more conversations, and what about this? And what happens if this occurs? It might be that you don't want to go into business anymore, that you don't want to buy that horse, that you don't want to have the lease. And we have people who have concerns about, you know, killing the deal. And my question to them is, well, if you think that this is going to kill the deal now, how do you feel? And we have to have the same expectation that if this came up later, it would kill the deal then too. So do you really want to be going into a contract or into an agreement where you know that there's potentially something in the future that could be so detrimental to the deal? Not sure if avoidance is the best strategy there. So
I have a friend who had an interesting situation where he had made a contract, I guess, at the bar with an employee about giving him half the business. And it was written on a bar napkin and signed by him. And that ended up being like legally held up.
Oh my gosh, that was my next question. Okay, I don't know. Obviously, nobody can see my face when you said that because my eyebrows went to the top of my forehead. But my next question was going to be, like, if you make a contract yourself and no lawyer was involved, like, that's still legally binding, right?
Definitely. A contract does not have to be written by an attorney. I would encourage everyone to put as much information and as much of their understanding about whatever it is that they're negotiating, or truly just like a memorial. That's a tricky word today, but truly just like whatever understanding that the parties have, to put it in writing. Of course, I think it's most likely going to be better if an attorney looks things over, because your attorney should have that kind of experience that's going to look out for your interests in a little bit more of a detailed way, like that choice of law provision that we were talking about earlier. But definitely, you can absolutely make your own valid and enforceable contracts. Just need to be careful with them because they can be enforceable. So if you're not very clear in how you write them, that could cause you issues later down the road.
And don't write contracts when you're drunk at a bar.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe not the best idea, but.
Yeah. We'll advise against that one.
Yeah. Maybe wait till the morning.
So we've kind of talked about, you've mentioned a few different types of contracts, like a waiver or a sales contract. What other types are there that you deal with a lot in the equine industry?
The big ones that I see are what you mentioned, leases, sales, breeding agreements, agreements with vets, like contracts to do pre-purchase examinations. The type of contract that I'm seeing a ton right now are joint ownership agreements. So as we've seen horses get more expensive, not only to buy, but to keep in recent years, I'm seeing a lot of people who want to put together some sort of joint ownership agreement, whether that be a formal partnership or some sort of arrangement. And they're looking for a contract that explains what everyone's understanding of that arrangement is going to be, which is great that people are thinking that far ahead.
And are there others, and also maybe any pertaining more to entrepreneurs and business owners as well?
Yeah, something that I see a lot of lately is agreements for people who are doing some sort of investment horse situation. And I think that that's become really popular. So a lot of people are buying horses typically from Europe or from somewhere else, or even just buying prospects here in the States. And then they have a partner. And I always tell clients, if you can dream it and it's legal, we can do it. So whatever situation, and I think I've seen just about every form or fashion of investment agreements or partnership or joint ownership agreement you can envision, we can make happen as long as it's clear and everybody agrees. So I've had situations where someone's putting up most of the capital, someone else is doing the training and the marketing. I've structured things where it's a 50-50 split. I've structured agreements where somebody's not getting paid out until the sale. Really, the sky's the limit when it comes to these types of agreements. It just, the more nuanced you get and the more specific you get and outside the norm, the more clear we need to be. And also with investment horses, a contract is a great way to make sure that everyone's on the same page, because I think most people go into an investment thinking that it's going to make money. And I mean, most of the time, but with horses, we all know that things can happen that are unexpected. So especially when you have someone who isn't as familiar with horses, or worse, knows just enough about horses to kind of get themselves into trouble. You really have to have a contract that spells out what's going to happen if this horse is lame, if it has to be rehabbed, if it doesn't sell, if the market changes. The industry is incredibly dynamic and things become popular, things don't become popular. And the value of horses is incredibly speculative. So the agreement needs to reflect all of these unknowns that no one can be completely prepared for, regardless of how long they've been doing it.
Right.
Yeah, you actually helped me with my contract for my business, which was great. And, you know, that was a little bit unique in that the structure of that and putting up the capital and how it was going to be reimbursed and distributed if the company was making money. And it was good to have that, because now I feel like, okay, you know, we have an understanding going forward.
And it's great that you were able to have those challenging conversations with your business partner early on. And hopefully, you know, you're really only looking at the contract in the future about how you guys are going to split your profits, but at least it's been addressed and everyone was informed going into it. And as we've all heard, you know, like lawyer fees are expensive, and the more clear you can be on the front end with what I would consider this to be an investment in the business, the less likely you're going to have issues later down the road, which could turn into litigation or could turn into some sort of misunderstanding that really requires professionals to dig in and figure out what everyone's rights are with this business or under this contract.
Yeah. I like that you say it's an investment in your business. I think we talk a lot about that in this podcast, of things that people really need to consider when they're starting a business, and probably just don't put into their budget to begin with. And I think legal fees is a big part of it. They think they can just pick a name and put up a website and get going. And you really need to think about everything that involves setting it up and protecting yourself. And that is, like you say, an investment to keep yourself out of trouble down the road.
Yeah, it's kind of like an insurance policy. I mean, you can never prevent someone from suing you. You could have the most wonderful waiver that's so comprehensive, but somebody can still sue you. And then we can rely on the waiver and say, look, this should be dismissed, because if you take a look at this contract or this waiver, you know, for these reasons. But that, and not a great situation to be in, but at least you have it. So even though a contract isn't going to completely mitigate all risk, it's going to help a lot.
What's important when contracts are being put together?
What do you mean by put together?
Like, what kind of points do you want to make sure are covered? Is there something specific people should be making sure they have in their contract?
Well, every situation is unique. So whatever is important to you is really what I want to make sure the agreement covers. There are always going to be a few things that I'd like to see in every agreement, like a choice of law provision, an attorney's fees provision. I like those, but you have to be careful about how you use them, because it's great if, you know, when you prepare the contract, that if you ever have to go enforce your rights under a contract, that you can get your attorney's fees back. Because let's say you have a contract and you know that you're right under the contract and you want to go enforce some sort of agreement that you have under that contract, that's still going to be really expensive. So an attorney's fees, it could be expensive. An attorney's fees provision will help you recoup those costs. You're still going to be paying them in real time, but in the end, at least you know when you're initiating some sort of contract dispute that you could get your attorney's fees back.
And can you talk us through a partnership contract? I think, you know, we've talked a little bit about that as, you know, people coming together to buy a horse, or, but it could also be people coming together to start a business, right?
Yes, it could be many different things. I'm seeing a lot of multi-owner partnership situations when it comes to buying and owning. And I think people use a lot of terms interchangeably. I hear partnerships, joint ownerships, even syndicates thrown out a lot. And some of them truly are synonymous. Like, a partnership can be more than one person. And every state has their own body of law when it comes to partnership. But it's so important that you go out of your way to make sure that everything is clear. Because in a lot of states, if you don't have a written partnership agreement, the court can infer that there was a partnership. So if you're doing, if you're working with someone and you don't have something set out, there could be this assumption that there is a partnership agreement. And the assumption would be that you are splitting the business.
Everything.
Yeah. And that's not always what everyone intends. So in some form or fashion, things have to be spelled out, because if not, you're going to run into trouble where either you're not on the same page with your partner, or they could use those inferences to their advantage.
Mm-hmm. Like if you invested all the money and your partner was, you know, doing, I don't know, some of the work, but if you didn't have a contract and you were in a state and you had, if you were fighting about it, the state could just say, oh, well, you have to split it up 50-50.
It could happen. And yeah, there would be a lot of evidence, I would imagine, where you're showing like, no, this was our understanding, or this was our understanding. And do you really want to be in a situation where you're battling it out and trying to prove that that was your understanding? And horses are kind of a weird business. Not exactly known for being profitable at all times. So do you want to be explaining to normal people that your business actually doesn't make? And that's who your juries are. That's who a judge is. They're not a horse person. So, you know, think about how compelling it's going to be when you're talking to a jury in Marion County, Ocala, and you're explaining that, you know, this horse that you imported from Europe, you were going to spend this amount of money to buy it and they were going to train it. But, oh, I was going to take 80% of this. And then there's commissions. Like, these are complicated issues, especially for someone who isn't in horses. So the notion of like industry standard, I think that's gone. There are some situations where we have an industry standard, but I have somebody who calls me every day and they're like, you know, like industry standard. And whatever you think that is whatever it is at that particular day. Like, if that's how you're doing it, that's how you think everyone's doing it. Everyone thinks that they're kind of like the norm. But I think things have changed. Horses, for better, well, I mean, I don't think it's for better, but horses have only gotten more litigious. The horse industry, they've gotten more expensive. They're more expensive to buy and keep. That is going to result in more litigation. When you're spending that amount of money on a horse, you can expect that there's going to be issues. And sometimes my most expensive litigation is actually not the really expensive horses. It is horses that are under six figures and people have spent a significant amount of their savings, their hard work. We all know how emotional we are about our horses. And these purchases are not just, oh, I'm buying like a horse for a business. No, these are emotional plans, hopes, and dreams, and all of that. And people will litigate that until it's resolved. So,
yeah. Okay. So going back to you talking about people who are outside the horse industry, I'm doing some pitching to venture capitalists and trying to explain to them equestrian clothing and like terms like shad belly. They're like, What are you talking about?
Oh my gosh. I can imagine.
All the normies. Yeah. So, you know, it is. It, like when you look at it from outside the industry, you have people come in and you're like, wait, you don't know what that term is, what that means?
Like, it can be so confusing and we don't realize it. Yeah. When I take depositions, I have to put on my not lawyer hat and act like I've never even seen a horse, because I want vets or horse trainers or whoever's being deposed to have a record that I can refer back to that actually makes sense. Otherwise, when I'm writing things, it's just footnote, footnote, footnote. This is the definition of like, this is soundness. This is
right.
It insert like whatever, you know, the case may be. I mean, even I can't think of like a really weird example, but you just keep talking and it I mean, even explaining what a farrier is, like,
right. Yeah.
Lingo. We have our own lingo.
Yeah. We have our own lingo. And
yeah.
Yeah.
It all just boils down to clarity, I think. And I mean, we keep harping on this in so many episodes of just be clear, just tell people exactly what it is from the outset, and it saves you so much trouble or heartbreak or money down the road. And I think contracts is such a big part of that.
And I know we've like touched on different types, but like sales contracts, why is it important to have sales contracts? Because that's something like I didn't grow up having. You sell a horse, maybe you give them something in writing that they paid X amount, and then you go on your way. What is important about sales contracts?
I didn't really grow up using them either. I mean, that was kind of my experience until truly becoming an attorney. But things have changed, and a lot of states require a sales contract. I know here in Florida, you have to provide a bill of sale for every horse sold. And Florida actually has some very strict requirements that are supposed to be included in every bill of sale. So you don't want to be in a situation where that's even like, not only are you required, okay, that's so messy. So some states require contracts, like in Florida, you have to have a bill of sale for every horse sold. But even if you're not required in your particular state to have some sort of contract or some sort of bill of sale, it just is a reflection that you guys did in fact agree that I was going to get paid this amount of money. You were going to take the horse. I've seen every horror story of a million and one sales that have went wrong where, oh, well, it was going to be a two-part payment. She was going to pay me the rest in 30 days, or they said that the horse could, you know, show in the 2-6, 2-9 hunters. Well, where? Like on the A circuit or at the local schooling show in Pennsylvania or in Wellington? Like what are we talking about when you're selling this horse? So super, super important. And sale litigation as a result of horse sales gone bad is the litigation that I see the most.
Wow.
In contrast, well, maybe not totally contrast, but in a lease contract, I assume you have to be just as detailed, right?
Ideally, I would like my clients to be as specific as possible, and then go through that exercise with the other side of what happens if during this lease the horse becomes lame. What happens if I get a different job and I need to move? Can I move the horse from this barn to the other? And I've seen some pretty harsh leases where the situation is you, as the person who's leasing the horse, are taking all of the risk. And that's fine. But you should know when you're reviewing it how much risk you're willing to take. What are the requirements? I mean, a year is a long time, and I see a lot of leases for a year. So I think that's something that people need to be cautious of. Not that they can't do it, but to think about what could happen. What happens if on day one, this horse is not going to work out? How do I feel for the next 364 days having it in my barn? And also, as the lessor, do you really want someone to be holding your horse that doesn't actually want it for the rest of the lease term? Maybe you do, and you know, it's off the bill for the rest of the year. But I don't know. It's something to think about, and everyone's priorities are different. So there's nothing that's good or bad about any of the situations. It just needs to be considered before you sign.
For sure. I know somebody who had a lease that went out and they signed the lease before they even tried the horse, and it did not work out. And they sent it back within a week, and they had signed the lease already and were held to that lease. And it kind of was what it was, but they didn't even really ask for money back because they're like, we understand, we signed the lease, like, my bad. Because it was also offered to take the horse on trial. And they said, no, 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 it'll be fine. Sounds great. Everything's great. Signed the lease. So, yeah, I mean, definitely like review it and think about it. And then I personally had a situation being asked about taking out a part of the lease that said what would happen if the horse was lost or stolen.
That is kind of concerning. Like,
yeah,
you think that you're gonna lose it.
Stolen, air quotes.
Ooh. Oh yeah. My gosh. Yeah, so. that would make me a little nervous.
Yeah, I mean, I talked to the insurance company, and you know, there were some things about it that they were like, well, I mean, it's covered in insurance, in this insurance policy. So, you know, but it was crazy. It was like,
I bet. Yeah. Leases are also, I think, growing in popularity. Sure.
Yeah.
Not anything new, but again, horses are getting more expensive to buy, to keep. So it can be really helpful to not have to shell out as much cash for a full purchase price. And you do have so many people who are coming in and want to compete. It's great to see the industry continuously evolve and have more people competing at higher levels, and seeing the caliber of horses also improve and see the market reflect that. But as it gets more expensive, of course you're going to have more and more leases. I mean, I encourage my clients to do some sort of PPE before they sign a lease, especially if it's going to be as robust as the one that you were talking about, where you're going to have it for an entire year. That should be, with the prices of some of these leases, that should be just as extensive of a vetting as a sale agreement.
Yeah, totally agree. Lease prices can be insane for some of the, like, equitation horses and stuff that people do.
And
ponies.
Yeah, and ponies. I think out of all of the leases and sale agreements I see, it definitely seems like the ponies can turn a really large profit. But again, not everything does. So we have to be prepared of, I know you think that this pony is going to be this cash cow, so to speak, but what happens if tomorrow it becomes unsound or is hurt? Yep. What are we going to do? At least a pony is, you know, eats a little bit less.
Right. So. They live on air. For sure.
I guess there's that.
What's your best advice for to make sure that, like, all parties are covered in contracts, just in general?
I think to just be as abundantly clear as you can be. I hear a lot about, oh, well, we wrote this because we had a conversation about X, Y, and Z, or I know that the contract says that you weren't going to get a refund, but I told them that if anything happened with the horse, just let me know and I'd give them their money back. But, like, look at the contract. And it's kind of like, no, this is not how we do things. We don't put things in writing that are opposite of what our conversations were. So being conscientious when you're drafting that agreement, making it really clear. I think everyone thinks that things are going to work out when they start any sort of venture. I mean, who buys something or leases something thinking that things are going to go south? Like, we all have the best of expectations. And I think everyone's doing the best that they can. And I understand not wanting to kill deals or just be a complete nuisance by, like, well, what about X, Y, and Z? And you want somebody to sign this 10-page contract. But at the very least, let's get the basics out there. And even if everything doesn't make it into the contract, you've had some sort of understanding with the other side about what is important to you and what isn't. We say in mediation that a good settlement is when both sides walk away a little unhappy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting.
So I think a contract, if I'm drafting it for my client, of course I'm going to make it as advantageous to my client as possible. But when people are putting together those types of agreements, there can be a trade-off of like, this is what I'm willing to risk. This is what's an absolute deal breaker for me. And I think the agreement just has to reflect that. Anything that you want to do, as long as it's legal, I think we can make it happen. It just needs to be clear. Someone needs to be able to understand it if in the future a situation occurs. Like, let's go back to the contract and see what it says.
Right. Cool. Well, thanks for helping us clear up some of these questions and understand more and really, you know, push that point again that people need to protect themselves and business owners do for sure. And at the end of each episode, we ask four questions to every guest.
What is your unfair advantage over others?
My unfair advantage is that I'm really good at building connections with people. When I tell people I'm a horse attorney, I usually get a few follow-up questions, but it seems like everyone has a horse story. They either say, oh, I rode a horse once, or my sister, my cousin, she has horses. Everyone seems to have a horse story, and horses just connect all of us, even if we're not horse people. So I think that my superpower is connecting with others.
That's awesome. But also back to your, what people say about horses. Do you ever get that you got run away with or bucked off or fell off?
Every time.
Oh yeah.
Every time.
Like. Yeah. I've never met anyone who was like, oh, horses. I've never seen a horse. Like, I've never pet. It's just, it's always something. I pet a horse once, it bit off my finger. There's always a story. I rode a horse once, it took off on the trail. Like, it's
always. There's not one nice trail horse on earth. Every single one of them bucks people off. I'm like, you gotta be kidding me.
I hope they had good
weight. You know what really happened is they probably just like started trotting.
Yes.
And
yes,
they just
absolutely.
Like off the side. Yes. And that felt like them bucking, you know, because they've never ridden a horse before.
And everyone thinks that their horse story is so crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're like, hold my beer.
Yeah.
Kimbrough, what's something worth fighting for, and what is something worth giving up?
I think something that is worth giving up is other people's opinion of you. And I say that, like, of course, we want people to respect us and think highly of us. And that's incredibly important for me, too. But doing what I do in this job as an equine attorney, I would be a terrible attorney if I made everyone happy all the time. And that's something that I've really had to make peace with, because I love being in this industry. And it also can be incredibly uncomfortable to be taking a deposition on Thursday and then being ringside on Saturday and like doing the whole awkward trying not to make eye contact. So that's challenging. And I think that knowing who you are, what your values are, and letting go of that perception is something that we all might benefit from a little bit. I know it's easier said than done, but everything to a degree. And I think something that most of us could do is let go of all the stories that we're telling ourselves in our heads. And I like to repeat to myself, someone else's opinion of me is none of my business.
Mm-hmm.
And just leave it at that.
What's your favorite age so far?
This age, I think every year it's whatever age I'm in. But I think the past year has been really exciting for me. I made the transition to practicing exclusively equine law close to 2 years ago. And especially in the beginning of my career as an attorney, it was really scary. And I mean, it's still scary, but you live in a state of just constant fear that you're going to do something wrong. And that, yeah, I think most people have that at the beginning of their careers. But especially in this one, it seems like your first few years as an attorney are incredibly nerve-wracking. And it's nice to kind of be over that and to have been doing this for a while, to have built really good relationships with people over the years. And I feel like this is such a fun time because I'm working with so many interesting clients and helping them. I'm now seeing the fruits of our labors to fruition. So I can't wait for 2028 and seeing clients compete at the Olympics on horses that I helped them do the joint ownership agreement on, or, you know, set up the partnership for. So I love this age right now because it's a reflection of all the years prior.
Yeah, I like that answer a lot.
Yeah, and who would you recommend as a guest for this podcast?
A guest I would recommend is Jackie Cohen. She owns Hoof Books. So Jackie is someone who I will refer a lot of clients to in order to get set up with accounting. I do not touch anything with taxes or accounting. Just the law. So constantly I have people who will reach out and they say, I want to do this, this, and this. And my immediate question is, okay, that's fine. Happy to do it for you. Did you already speak to an accountant? Because if you feel comfortable with it, it's fine. But it might be a good idea to big picture logistics, how are we going to operate this business? And then we'll decide what entity we want versus let's set up an entity and then go back and figure out how we're going to do our bookkeeping or our taxes. Mm-hmm. So if people can work with some sort of tax or accounting professional, or at least do a little bit of their own research, I think that that's a much safer, like it's just more safe when they're creating legal entities and drafting contracts and those sorts of things.
Yeah.
So Jackie's great at that and she's a horse person. So she gets it. And that's why people call attorneys and bookkeepers who are horse people, because we get it. And can give it advice that's actually helpful versus you're explaining to your accountant, like, yeah, I know this was a lot of money for equipment, like a saddle, but it was necessary. And I can't even imagine what accountants think when they see like the shipping charge from Europe.
Right. I always say I keep like my finance guy and my accountant, they're both horse people, like degenerate horse people. And so they enable me a lot.
I love that. Yes. Yes. And that's what we need. We need people to enable us.
Yeah.
That's what I do for my clients.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. It was great talking to you and can't wait to see you at an event down the road somewhere soon.
Yes, thank you for having me. And I am looking forward to our next EQ Businesswomen event.
Awesome.
Thanks. I really like Kimbrel. She has been such a great supporter of Equestrian Businesswomen. She's come to so many of our events. She's always engaged at the events. And I just love that about her. And also, that's why I hired her to help me out with some of my partnership agreement stuff.
I love that Equestrian Businesswoman has led us to people like her who can help us with aspects of our own business. So it's great that you've made that connection and have somebody like her to rely on with things, you know, outside of Equestrian Businesswomen.
Yeah. And it's related to the equine industry. So it's helpful that she knows and kind of can follow what I'm looking for. I think that sometimes that makes all the difference. Like we were talking about saying, you know, having accountants and financial people involved that understand horses is always helpful. And that's why I think that, you know, when they're making contracts in the equine industry, having somebody who understands the lingo and then can convert it into, I don't want to say normal or regular, but common ways and language.
Right. Yeah, that everyone can understand, even if they don't, they aren't in the industry.
Yeah, because it seems like that is probably an important point that she made when she was talking that, you know, the law, when you have to explain it to non-horse people, it can get, it can make it a little messy and sticky. So being able to have that ability to kind of put things into regular terms, I think is, seems like it's important. The law just seems messy to me, honestly.
Oh, gosh, me too. I couldn't do it. You know, I took the LSAT and applied to law school. And I'm just so glad I never went. Oh, I don't know. I don't know if I'd be a good lawyer. Maybe, but it's a lot of detail.
Lots of detail, and things can switch, and the different states, you know, that's why I was like asking about what about, you know, different states and whose state has jurisdiction, because most, let's face it, most of our contracts in the equine industry are made in with
state
people,
to state.
Yeah. Like outside of the state.
Yeah.
You know, so that's crazy. But I liked the point too that it's a little bit kind of going back to Andrea talking about it's an investment for the future. This is the same kind of thing with the contracts. It's an investment for the future. So while it may cost you some money up front, it may save you some in the long run.
I think definitely. She always impresses me with, like she was talking about her unfair advantage of making connections. You know, she originally came from the quarter horse world.
Yes.
And now she's like firmly in the hunter jumper world, which is cool. So I love that she's got like all those connections across different parts of the industry too.
Yeah. And so talking about that, she went to the Kentucky Derby, and it was funny because she reached out to me knowing that I have connections in racing, just asking me, hey, I want to go to the Kentucky Derby. I'm going to be by myself. Do you know anybody who's going that I could connect with? And I like that she uses her network to, and I wasn't very helpful because the people that I know were not going this year. And so, you know, I wasn't helpful, but she found somebody to go with her, and that was great. And it sounds like she had a great experience. So that's awesome. But I like people who do that, who can like, she's right. She can like problem solve. Right. So she was like, who do I know? And, you know, let me reach out, because what's the worst I could say? No, I don't know anybody.
Like, right. Yeah.
My response was, you know what, let me ask around and see if I do know anybody who's going to be there.
Yeah, I think you're good at that too. And that's what I try and do as well. That's what I like doing, is like, is connecting people. And I know like where I can go for certain connections and who I can go to be like, I need somebody's phone number, or I need you to tell somebody that I need to talk to them, or whatever it is. So I appreciated that about her as well.
Yeah. I think that that's probably why we all get along so well.
Yeah.
No, it was great to have her on and kind of talk through, because we've said it a million times how important contracts are. So, you know, it's nice to get a clearer picture of, you know, the different types and what you need to look for, and really kind of reiterate, you know, it's important to have like legal professional eyes on contracts. I think especially in this day and age where everybody wants to put everything into ChatGPT. I mean,
like, don't do that.
No, like, how about you go to a professional and get their eyes on it? And, you know, it's probably worth the money, so that in the long run, you can make sure that you are covered and you're not fighting uphill legal battles for years.
And spending 10 times, 20 times the money it would have cost you to upfront to just have a proper contract in place.
Yeah, I think that was one of the most important takeaways of this episode.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to move forward in our planning for Saratoga Women in Business. And we're going to wrap up this episode today. We have a lot of planning going on for things in the future. So you can find the links to today's guests and the show notes at www.eqbusinesswomen.com. Equestrian B2B is out twice a month on the 1st and the 15th.
Find out more at eqbusinesswomen.com and follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Find Equestrian B2B wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to follow, subscribe, and leave a review.
Now go review your contracts.